Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half or so here on Unbelievable. And a very special guest joining me on the programme today, Amy Orr Ewing, one of our keynote speakers at Unbelievable, the conference this year. And if you want to come along to hear Amy and a whole raft of other wonderful speakers, including Alistair McGrath, Peter S. Williams, Fuzz Rana, Dr. Trevor Stammers and others beside, then I do encourage you to check out the website. Get your tickets. That's premier.org.uk/Jesus. Again, premier.org.uk/Jesus. A special offer as well. If you book two or more tickets, you get last year's conference on DVD absolutely free. So a great excuse to invite a friend along with you as well. It's all about defending your faith in the public sphere. Perhaps you have friends who are sceptical of the claims of Christianity. This is the conference to come along to get, you know, knowledge, to interact with interesting speakers, to think through the questions for yourself. It's a great way of doing it across the course of a day. Loads of different seminars. premier.org.uk/Jesus for Unbelievable, the conference 2013 on Saturday the 25th of May in central London. And as I mentioned, I'm so thrilled today to be joined by Amy Orr Ewing, one of the speakers at the conference. Let's meet her now here on the programme that aims to get you thinking.
You're unbelievable.
And just to give a little bit of introduction to Amy, she's the Director of Programmes for the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, known as the OCHA, and UK Director for Arzim Zacharias Trust. At this year's conference, she's going to be speaking on subjects including Jesus the Legend, Can We Trust the Biblical Accounts of Christ? And also, of course, a big C.S. Lewis year this year. So C.S. Lewis and Suffering is another seminar that she'll be tackling. How do we answer the problem of pain? Amy, thank you so much for joining me on the programme today.
Well, thanks for having me. Hi, Justin.
It's great because we haven't had you on for literally years and years, actually.
I think that's right.
It seems like the early days of the programme.
I think that's right. My excuse is that I've been having children. Is that all right?
Yeah, well, I had some children too, but I managed to turn up.
Yes, okay.
No, fair enough. I know how time consuming that can be. We're going to be hearing in the course of today's programme from a few different voices. We're doing the what I sometimes call griller Christian format. Yes. You being the Christian being grilled,
okay.
And
yes.
Just a variety of questions that are going to come up in the course of today's programme. We're going to be hearing from Trevor on the reliability of the Gospels. He's got an interesting question to ask around that. Rachel, who has been on the programme before, she took part in a slightly wacky thing we did last year called the Atheist Prayer Experiment.
Well, that sounded fascinating, yeah.
Well, she's back to talk about where she sits, having rejected Christianity and just the notions of loving enemies and dying to self, those kinds of issues she'd like a general discussion on. And we'll have Jay as well coming on the line, who's from the States. Lots of interesting issues to look forward to in the programme today. You'll feel at least toasted, if not roasted, by the end of the programme, Amy.
Thank you anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Get ready. I'd just like to spend a little time, though, talking about your journey, though, Amy.
Sure.
Because you've been doing a lot of speaking. You speak all over the world. You lead missions. You do evangelism, particularly focusing on answering people's fundamental concerns, objections to Christianity. Does this stem from personal experience? Did you ever go through a period of doubting yourself in your Christian journey?
That's a great question. I think for me, I'm really passionate that the Christian faith should contend with other worldviews, other ideas on the same footing, and that, you know, we want to kind of invite questioning and invite dialogue, that there shouldn't be a defensiveness or a fear about, you know, disagreement. And I think part of that does come from my own personal history. My grandfather was a very committed atheist. He actually forbade the family from having a Bible in the house. And
really?
So, yeah, I mean, he's a brilliant scientist, and but really quite a fundamentalist atheist. And my father really grew up in that sort of tradition, became an academic, worked in various universities. And only really in his 30s, after my sister and I were born, did he even question that there might be something. And, you know, but he was, certainly wasn't sort of on a big religious quest or anything. And it was into that beginning of a question that he had a quite direct personal experience of Christ, and then began a sort of more intellectual journey of questioning the evidence for the Christian faith. So when he then did become a Christian, it made just a huge difference in our family. Everything changed. And I definitely wasn't brought up in a culturally religious home at all. You know, we were really encouraged to question and pursue belief in God for ourselves, but not to be afraid of disagreement or not believing. And I really appreciate that. It wasn't a sort of feeling forced into religion. And then, but I did discover God for myself. You know, I saw God at work in amazing ways, miraculous ways, as well as discovering him through the Bible. And then I came up to Oxford to study theology in the 90s, at which point the faculty here was really quite unbelieving, in the sense that, you know, they were interested in ideas of God, but they certainly weren't many practicing Christians, or sort of evangelical Christians, you might call them. So I spent 3 years really studying some of those questions, but being quite thrown by some of the questions and having to investigate again for myself, is this really true? Does it stand up to scrutiny? And by the end of those 3 years, I think I was more persuaded really than before. So
this whole quest to academically find whether the Bible is trustworthy and reliable and so on, did you in the end feel like you were able to present a case even to your tutors and the academics in Oxford that kind of put the case as you saw it?
Well, because of the Oxford tutorial system, you sort of had to do that every week, but which was great. I'm so thankful for that, and I'm actually really thankful for those who, you know, challenged me, although we disagreed in the end. It was done with very, you know, kindness and good humour, etc. Yes, I did have opportunities to do that. I actually did a viva at the end of my degree, which is a sort of oral test, which is quite unusual for an undergraduate degree. And
it is. I mean, I was about to say I was at Oxford and did PPE. I think probably not dissimilar time to you, but
yes,
I've never heard of anyone sitting a viva
undergraduate
degree.
It was quite unusual. Tom N.T. Wright's book, Jesus and the Victory of God, had just come out, and I was using some of his thoughts and arguments around the historical Jesus in my Gospels paper, and they were quite controversial, shall we say, at the time. So I did have to sort of defend my views in that context, which was pretty intimidating. 14
wow.
Dons of the university and me. But actually at the end, I was really, really lucky to get a first. And my the head of my college, Christchurch, was a theology tutor, and we sat next to each other at a dinner, and he said, "We haven't cured you of your evangelical views, have we?" And we laughed about it, and we talked about some of the reasons, and I, you know, really appreciate that.
How interesting. Since then you've stayed in Oxford to some extent, at least in terms of your involvement with the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, though.
Yes.
You're very much involved in local church ministry as well with your husband Frog, which
yes.
Everyone is thinking, what an odd name, but I'm
yes.
sure you get that
just,
all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a nickname, but it has stuck. Yes.
And
right.
I suppose, do you find that's important to have be rooted in local pastoral ministry as well as obviously doing the big thinking stuff?
Yeah, I really do. I think, you know, as part of my job, I'm involved in lecturing and trying to answer people's questions all over the world, and sometimes in quite, you know, exciting places, at universities or, you know, more kind of political situations. But I think the reality of God at work in ordinary people's lives, in the nitty-gritty of that, has been tremendously important for me. And, you know, we spent 7 years in Peckham in southeast London, and I really discovered there that apologetics, you know, talking about some of these reasons isn't really a question of education. So, you know, some young people who perhaps got involved in street gangs and that kind of thing had really, really profound questions and were really capable of thinking those things through and challenging some Christian assumptions. You know, I really appreciated that, and I think I saw that whether you're an Oxford professor or, you know, incredibly academic erudite person, or whether you're a really bright person who's, you know, on the streets and living by your wits, that some of these questions are universal. They're the same. You know, that's quite humbling.
Yeah, absolutely. We're really looking forward, as I say, to having you at this year's conference in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.
And very often this becomes a bit of an issue in the area that we term apologetics, but that there's a lack of many female speakers. And I was so pleased when you said, yes, I can come to the conference this year, because I thought, brilliant. Because I don't know if you feel the same way, but apologetics does tend to be kind of a male-dominated area a lot of the time.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's a particular kind of man that can be attracted to it as well. It can be, it can become very sort of confrontational or aggressive or sort of very detail-orientated, rather than sort of big picture or focus on the person. But for me, that's not what a kind of biblical understanding of this word is. It means a reasoned defence, a kind of legal defence you might give in a court of law. And as we know, you know, any decent lawyer appeals to logic, evidence, but also the personal human story. It's a holistic thing. And that's so crucial for me about the Christian faith, that this is not a set of propositions. It's not only about ideas, although ideas are important. It's about a personal God who actually exists and people coming to know him, as well as discovering evidence for him and things about him.
Yeah. Well, all the very best. And I know that you are championing at the Ocker various excellent female apologists.
We've got really wonderful women speakers and apologists here, absolutely. Yeah, there's a whole community of us, which is great.
Well, we had Sharon Dirks on the show not so long ago.
Who's written a
really interesting new
brilliant
book.
Brilliant scientist. So, on suffering, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you again. And of course, Alistair, who is involved at the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics, will be speaking as well at the conference.
Yes.
And lots of different seminars. And we're going to be touching on at least an aspect of one of the things you're speaking on with our first caller into the show today, who's Trevor. We'll be speaking to him in a moment about the reliability of the New Testament. If you're listening and you'd like to participate in terms of giving a response to anything you hear on the show today, giving your thoughts on any of the subjects that come up, I do encourage you to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And you may be interested to leave your thoughts as well via Twitter or Facebook. @unbelievablejb is the Twitter handle. If you want to follow me, send me a message. You can also like the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/unbelievablejb. All of those details and how to listen back to this programme, more resources on Amy and the conference and so on, all available, of course, from the website. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So time to talk to our first person on the line. As I say, we're doing the Guerrilla Christian format, which any regular listener of Unbelievable might be familiar with. We take a few calls across the course of the show. It's more of a bite-sized interactions on the show today as Amy addresses some of the questions and conversations from various people. Trevor is on the line, first of all. Trevor, thank you for being with us.
Morning, Justin. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Good to have you with us. Trevor, you've a fairly long-time listener, I think, of the show, aren't you?
Yeah, it must be going back about 5 years or so. Is that possible?
It's perfectly possible. I think we've been doing this. Well, I think in October we'll be 8 years old as a show, which
wow.
It's hard to believe. Yeah, but as old as my youngest son, eldest son, even. So there you go. That's how I measure it. Thank you for coming on today. You're not a Christian. Have you ever had any kind of faith background?
Yes, I was brought up sort of within a church, sort of very much surrounded by Christianity. I guess I wasn't sure what I was for most of my childhood. Sort of just when I was about 18 or 19, having a bit more sort of clarity that I definitely didn't believe. That's been the case ever since.
Evidently still interested in the issues as a regular listener of the show.
There's always links to church. I'm still in touch with my local church and many friends are religious as well.
So, okay.
Well, yes, I think it's just an interest that won't go away.
Let's talk about the subject that you're coming on to sort of ask some questions about. You've got quite an interesting way of framing it as we talk about the reliability of the New Testament and the stories of Jesus and so on. How did you want to put this to Amy?
Well, morning, Amy.
Hi, morning.
So I was trying to think of a way to put the reliability of the Gospels in a modern context. So, for example, would it be comparable to, say, getting eyewitness testimony from somebody who was at Woodstock about something that had happened at Woodstock? The reason I'm opting for Woodstock is that it sort of happened about 40 years ago, which is around about the same time as time lapses from the crucifixion to the writing of the first gospel.
And for those who
give or take a decade or two,
are uninitiated, this is the Woodstock Music Festival that took place in America.
I thought you were about to say, for those who are uninitiated, that would be about 33 AD. And then had 40. Sorry, Justin, threw me off there for a moment.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
Okay. So that's kind of how you're framing the question, Trevor.
Yeah.
And so is your question sort of, are we expecting kind of a similar way of documenting what we know happened at Woodstock? Would we expect similar amounts of evidence?
Well just it seems a very long time ago now. It's before I had any memories. I can't imagine remembering something 40 years ago. I guess we wouldn't expect that to be very reliable yet. I guess should we expect more from the
yeah.
Gospels?
I tell you one story just as we're on this. My dad, child of the 60s, he went to the famous Isle of Wight Festival where Jimi Hendrix played his last performance in the UK. He slept through the whole thing.
He wouldn't have been a reliable eyewitness.
No, exactly. Yeah. But, anyway, Amy, yeah, carry on.
I mean, I think that's a brilliant question. I mean, AD 70 would be about the latest you could date the writing of the first gospel. I think increasingly people are pushing it earlier, so the time lag is probably smaller than 40 years. But give or take, for us, that might seem like a long time. But in terms of ancient equivalents, actually, the New Testament is highly unusual, really, in being so close to the events that it records. So we have to think about comparing like with like. I think the other thing I would say is that oral tradition and memory capacity and traditional practices of passing on memories are completely different from today. So, you know, ancient Jews and Greeks had a sort of culture of meticulously memorizing and committing quite complex traditions to memory. So you could look at that tradition and say, make an argument, I think, for the Gospels really transmitting what happened. And for me, though, I think there are sort of two crucial details which have only really come out in the last few years, you know, from academic scholarship, that help us to see whether that genuinely is the case, you know, whether the Gospels are actually recording what happened. And it was a study that was done by a German scholar who made a list of all the names that people were called within the Jewish context of Palestine in the period that we're talking about when the Gospels were written, using sort of archaeology and inscriptions, just compiling Jewish names in Palestine. And she did a study of the 3,000 names that emerge and looked at their popularity, and then did various kind of statistical analysis of it. And then a theologian called Richard Balkman picks this study up and compares it with the Gospels. And what we see is that if you take the sort of 9 top Jewish Palestinian male names together, outside of the New Testament, they are 41% of name usage. And inside the New Testament, they are 40% of name usage. And that's a pattern that shows up over 4 writers writing 5 books. Now, you know, that's one tiny example, but it's an example of a detail that it would be quite easy to get wrong if you were writing about events that you didn't really have a great memory of. The things that tend to slip out are the details, like names and dates and things. So I think that's the first thing, sort of name usage. And then
let's have Trevor just your thoughts on that. I don't know if you've come across that sort of stuff before. I think it was a while ago. We did have Richard Borkham on the show, and we did cover this a little bit. But
right, I think I might have missed that one. I suppose like a question that would be interesting is for me just like to have some comparison of like 100 years afterwards where. You know, were the names vastly different, or is this something that's relatively consistent?
Well, what's interesting is if you compare, so she also then did a study of male Jewish names at this time in Egypt, so really not very far away at all, and the top 8, 9, 10 names are completely different, and they're not the names used in the Gospels. In other words, the Gospel writers get that detail right, and they also get the sort of right features of names. So, for example, Simon is the top most popular name. So you can imagine if you called out Simon in the first century Jewish context, like loads of Simons would turn round. And so someone who knew that and who was familiar with the culture and was actually recording how things were would know that you would need to distinguish, to differentiate between Simons. And that's exactly what we see in the Gospels. Jesus has two Simon disciples, you know, Simon Kephas and Simon the Zealot. He has dinner with Simon the leper. There's Simon of Cyrene. And then Simon Peter in the book of Acts stays with a guy called Simon the Tanner. So you see that the Gospels, without knowing about this study, you know, it's written in 2003, they reflect very genuinely, very naturally, what would have been the case in quite a sort of detailed way. And we also see it in the way that speech is reported. So when speech is reported, John is differentiated as John the Baptist. But when the narrator is talking, you know, he doesn't need to differentiate. So that's a great piece of evidence that the Gospel writers are actually not just making up the speech, you know, making up the detail of it. They're actually reporting direct speech, which to me is quite interesting. I do think your Woodstock analogy is interesting, though, on one other point, which is that there were thousands of people at Woodstock and there were thousands of people around at the time of Jesus. And so if we were to have 4 biographers writing their account of what happened at Woodstock, they could be challenged by other people who were there for false reporting. Even now, 40 years later, there will be people who were alive then who remember what happened. And that's given our, you know, terrible memorization record as a culture, in contrast an oral tradition culture.
And the Gospel writers, many of the details in the Gospels would have been only seen by a few people at the time.
There were quite a few instances where there were large crowds, like the crucifixion or the Sermon on the Mount or the feeding of the 5,000. And also, you know, in those sorts of cultures, stories would have spread. You know, if Jairus really did have a daughter who was raised from the dead, you can imagine that people would have known that that happened on an epic scale, even if they weren't there at that moment. So I personally think it's really interesting that Luke understands that. You know, he very explicitly says, you know, I've carefully investigated. He understands that there are going to be people in his audience who will be able to pick him up if he gets details wrong. And for me, that's a great piece of evidence for the reliability of the New Testament.
Just got a couple of minutes, so yes. If you had anything to add or to ask in response.
Sure, I suppose just in, again in the spirit of putting it in a modern context, we do see large sort of cults emerge sort of in relatively recent history as well. So we know that it is possible for large numbers of people to vehemently believe a rumor that we don't believe actually happened. And also, it seems it was a fairly narrow window of this oral reliability, because by the second century, there are many kind of false gospels being created, or gospels that are generally acknowledged to be not reliable.
But I think that's precisely the point, isn't it? That by the third century, when there is a time lag between the events and the people writing gospels, that's when the sort of wild stories and the slightly more crazy things tend to come in. And interestingly, on the names thing, if you look at the Gnostic gospels, they don't have names. What drops out are the details. So they have the name of Jesus, but they only name Jerusalem, whereas, you know, in the gospels you have over 30 places named, lots of which were very tiny, inconsequential places that wouldn't necessarily have shown up on Roman maps. So I think the point that you make actually underscores how reliable the gospel writers were as biographers.
Much more that could be said, and apologies, because in the nature of the guerrilla Christian type format, we never get to we can only scratch the surface of these things.
But, sure, yeah,
absolutely. But, thanks, Trevor.
But Trevor, thank you. Yeah.
Question.
No, thanks.
I hope that helps. Anyway,
thanks.
Go and have a check out Richard Borkham. I think you might be intrigued. It's called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, and he's a great scholar, and he's got quite a lot of interesting stuff to say.
And
sounds interesting.
And what I'll do as well is from this programme today, link to the episode we had with Richard talking about that book as well. So check back for that, Trevor, and you'll be able to hear him in person talking about it with another New Testament scholar, James Crossley, on that occasion. Great stuff. Thank you very much for being on
thanks
the line today. All the very best. That's it.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you.
Bye.
That's Trevor, first of our callers today. We're going to be hearing from Rachel next, former Christian, who's going to be talking about sort of where she's at now in her journey of faith or not faith, and sort of open-ended discussion next with her, and more to come on from others as well. You're listening to Unbelievable, Saturday afternoon. Don't forget we're online as well if you want to listen back to this conversation. A Guerrilla Christian with Amy Orr Ewing, one of our guests at Unbelievable, the conference this year. Then do check it out online, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And I'll be back with Amy in just a moment's time.
Is science and religion incompatible? If you're a youth group leader and you want to start a discussion in a way that engages young minds, try Science and Belief, an exciting resource now available online. Simply gather your group together, download the leader's notes, watch one of 12 fascinating short videos on YouTube, and let the mind-expanding conversations begin. And there's an online questionnaire, as we'd love your feedback. Visit retoday.org.uk/scienceandbelief.
Welcome back to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. Thank you for joining me, Justin Brierley, on the show that aims to get you thinking, that connects Christians and non-Christians together. And today we're doing a Guerrilla Christian with Amy Orr Ewing, who is one of our speakers at Unbelievable, the conference. You'll get to grill her there if you come along on Saturday the 25th of May in just a couple of weeks' time. Some fascinating seminars on offer, and Amy specifically will be speaking on Jesus the Legend. Can we trust the biblical accounts of Christ? Which is, of course, what we were talking about with Trevor just a moment ago. C.S. Lewis and suffering. How do we answer the problem of pain? A perennial question. And I can't imagine most people haven't at some point either been forced to look at that question themselves or seen friends who have asked that question. Why? Why does God allow suffering? Just two of the seminars. Those are the ones Amy will be contributing on. But many more besides. Speakers include Alistair McGrath, Peter S. Williams, Fuzz Rana, Kurt Jaros, and it's all in connection with our partners, Reasons to Believe, Real Clear Apologetics, and RE Today Services. Do book your place on what is really the Evangelism and Apologetics Conference of the Year in Central London, premier.org.uk/Jesus. That's premier.org.uk/Jesus. Let's get back into today's programme. We're going to be hearing from Rachel, who's got some questions to ask of Amy.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
As I say, it is the Gorilla Christian format where we take a few different callers across the course of the programme with their questions or things they want to put to our Christian guest, in this instance, Amy Orr Ewing, who is the Director of Programmes for the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics and a mother of a number of children involved in local church ministry. Very busy woman, but has made some time in her schedule to talk to us here on the programme. Let's say hello, first of all, though, to Rachel, who's next on the line. Rachel, how are you doing?
I'm okay, thanks, Justin. I'm going to be doing so much grilling as maybe sort of light, shallow frying, because I'm not really hoping to you know, put Amy under the spotlight and force her to justify what she believes.
That's fine. We like the variety. Rachel, for those who may be thinking, have I heard her voice somewhere before? You were on the programme last year when we did that thing called the Atheist Prayer Experiment.
Yes.
And you were certainly one of the most interesting participants because as an atheist or non-believer, you had some interesting sort of things to report on your blog as you undertook a 40-day period of time praying to God at least once a day. And in that time, in a sense, some of the things you said made some people think, surely she is hearing from God. But that wasn't the way you saw it in the end, was it?
It wasn't the way that I interpreted it. And what I did find interesting was certainly my own emotional reaction to having the experiences where I would hear it wasn't hearing voices in any sort of, you know, put that woman in a straitjacket and lock her up kind of way. But, you know, the sort of strong thoughts which... I remember when I was a Christian, because I was brought up Christian and it was my faith for many years, the sort of strong thoughts which I would associate with God, which tended to be sort of quite wise directions and just all loving and compassionate thoughts. And I did have some of those during the Atheist Prayer Experiment, some of which I wrote about on my blog. I mean, and ultimately I came to the conclusion, well, I don't think they are God, but actually I'm not going to close myself off to them because I'm an atheist and this does not fit in with my conceptual idea of what life is about. It was helpful. I don't need to categorize it. I don't need to conceptualize it. I will work with this. If it's helping me to be more open with other people and live more productively, then I'll go with this. So that's the sort of conclusion I came to. And since then I've been meditating every day. As I've mentioned to you, I've become what I would call a secular Buddhist, which is I do subscribe to a lot of, you know, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. I find a lot of wisdom in the teachings and a lot of useful, very productive results from meditation.
On the back of that, what was the kind of area that you were interested in speaking to Amy about?
Well, I certainly remember when I was a Christian, and I don't know where, I mean, obviously Christian is a broad church, you know, no pun intended, that there was a real reluctance to admit that there might be value in practices from other faith or philosophical. And I was looking myself this morning at the Sermon on the Mount, and there's some pretty challenging stuff in that. And to really live out these things, I mean, I was just thinking that about, you know, you don't commit murder, but actually if you get angry with someone, you're already halfway there. And about adultery and lust and love for enemies, it seems to me that actually some of the Buddhist practices about being aware of your thoughts and seeing where they're leading and seeing what sort of suffering they're going to cause so that you can drop them before they become ingrained. And the whole teaching on love for enemies is a certain meditation practice carry on.
Well, I was going to say, I'd be just interested to get some thoughts on Amy. Lots there to think about, Amy. But that general question about, as a Christian, how do you respond to the idea that of incorporating other practices or techniques from other religions that may be helpful?
I think that's a fascinating question. The first thing that sort of springs to mind as I was listening to you is the brilliant Christian teacher Francis Schaeffer, who was an apologist, who famously said, "All truth is God's truth." So, if God is real and He really is the creator of the world, then anything that is true is not to be feared as part of part of His reality. So, I would relate to a certain extent with what you say, but I do think that It was great to hear as you were talking the sort of value of the human person really coming through in what you were saying. But for me, I think that's best explained by or founded in the idea of a God who's created human life as sacred rather than a kind of atheist, materialist, reductionist view of human beings. We're just physics and chemistry. There's no morality. It's the survival of the fittest. Or even a kind of traditional Buddhist understanding, which is a sort of essential denial of the person and of personhood. So Brahman is ultimate impersonal reality and Nirvana is oneness with the one. It's a sort of loss of consciousness and a loss of the person. Whereas for me, I think what was coming through from what you were saying was love of people and a desire for relationship. And I would really agree with that. I have I think as human beings, we have an inherent desire for relationship and an intrinsic sense of the value of human life. But I think that's sort of best explained by a creator God rather than a reductionist view or a view of ultimate impersonal reality. And then those were my thoughts as you were talking. But then onto the question of, you know, can we learn things from people that we don't agree about everything with them? Yes, of course. I really think we can. I think, you know, there are loads of atheistic scientists who I can learn loads from them. They have a massive contribution to make. But I would understand that within the wider framework of truth. Someone like Gandhi, who was a Hindu and a pacifist, and he talked about Christians and said, I love your Christ, I hate your Christians, you know, which I think is a prophetic message to the church. And I think things can be learned from his life. As a Christian, I think I would definitely meditate. I mean, the Psalms say, you know, talk about meditating on God's word, but it would probably be a different kind of meditation. You know, within Eastern religion, of course, meditation is about emptying the mind and a loss of individuality and personhood and oneness with this impersonal one. But for me, meditation is about meditating on the words from a person in the context of a relationship. So it's more about love than sort of impersonal reality. Does that make sense? So I think we can learn, but obviously that is within a bigger picture.
Okay, I mean, well, one thing that I would first of all say to that is I think there's a misunderstanding of what meditation is in the context, certainly the type of meditation that I practice. There are different types. There's not this emptying your mind so that actually you're in some kind of a trance. It's about dropping your thoughts so that you are wholly present to what is actually happening, so that you are experiencing reality as it is, rather than through the prism of your mind chatter saying, well, this is that and this is that. And there's a type of meditation practice called Vipassana, which is sort of like awareness meditation. And there's that type of meditation and one called metta, which is loving kindness meditation, which, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, I think can actually could be really useful in terms of putting into practice, say, the teachings in the Sermon on the Mount. And there's a lady called Mary Joy Meadow, who is a Christian, and she has written a couple of books on a Christian application of these two types of meditation. And I've not read those books, so I can't say exactly how she translates them in. But the idea of being aware of your thoughts, if sin begins with the thought, then when you become aware of the thought, I mean, how can you know? This is sort of like in Romans, that Paul says, I do what I don't want to do. And my thought was, you know, me too, you know, me too. And I think everyone does. But the more you become aware of how these impulses arise and the suffering that they cause both to you and to others, it stops being, well, I shouldn't do that. And this is going to hurt. I'm going to let it go like a hot potato. I'm just going to drop it. Mm. Awareness can be really useful. And certainly the metta meditation, which is about it's really about sort of the formal practice is about saying loving phrases of loving kindness and goodwill towards a variety of different people, including those you might consider to be enemies. And it just strikes me that when Jesus says, love your enemies, you can say, well, all right, then I will. But how? How do you overcome? You know, the meta-meditation is by actually focusing on... the meditation is about cultivating loving thoughts towards all beings. I mean, I guess in a Christian context, it might be praying for all beings.
Yeah, let's hear from Amy on that.
Gosh, it's hard to know where to start. We could talk about this all day, couldn't we? I think that for me, in terms of the love of enemies and thinking about sort of overcoming sinful thoughts, the most important element would be to have a recognition that I need help to do that, and that I look to and lean on a personal God who's actually there. And we talk about, you know, the Trinity. So the role of the Holy Spirit in enabling me to forgive my enemies, or you know, convicting me of sinful thoughts and then giving me the power to change. So for me, that would be missing in just a purely kind of intellectual or mental meditation. So the biblical tradition of meditation comes out of a, you know, rich Jewish heritage where you're interacting both with ideas but also with a personal God, and inviting the work of that real being into your own life and reflecting on those words. So it's almost like a three-way thing rather than a two-way thing.
I mean, if I can throw my tuppence in, I think some people like to kind of see Jesus as a sort of spiritual guru almost, and you could probably take bits of what Jesus does and apply it in that way. So I can imagine that many people who practice meditation of the kind that Rachel was talking about would say, you know, when Jesus talks about consider the lilies of the valley, they don't spin, you know, to have beautiful clothes and how, you know, so don't worry about what's coming tomorrow. It's a sort of a sense of living in the moment, living now, don't kind of, you know, and from that perspective, those sentiments could be picked up by people of different faiths and who practice the sorts of meditation that you're talking about, Rachel, in that way. Is there anything wrong with that, I suppose, Amy, at one level, or is it a case of just seeing the balance of
no, I'd get back to what Schaefer says, you know, all truth is God's truth. But I, for me as a Christian, I would not want to sort of pursue a path that was looking at my own transformation through my own efforts. You know, that within the Christian tradition is a sort of dead end. You know, there's this quite strong indication both from within ourselves but also from the evidence that we see in the world that we need a savior, we need rescue, we need help, and we're created for relationship, we need relationship with God, and that meditation within a context of relationship is a sort of different thing, really, I think.
Well, thank you so much for being on the line today. And it's great to catch up with you again, Rachel.
Hi, nice to speak to you too. And nice to speak to you too, Amy.
Yeah, really nice to speak to you.
All the very best. Thank you so much. That's Rachel joining us for this section of the programme. We're going to speak to someone else again in a moment's time. We're going to be hearing from Jay. So keep tuned for that in just a moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And if you want to get in touch on today's programme, I'd love to hear from you. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the place to send your emails in. Don't forget we're available on Twitter @unbelievablejb or facebook.com/unbelievablejb if you want to like the page. All those links and more besides information about the Unbelievable Conference where Amy is speaking and much more besides all available at the website where you can find today's programme as a podcast. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Well, we've been taking a number of callers across the course of the show today, and it's time for our final caller for the show, who is Jay. Jay, thank you for coming on the line with us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Now, I know it's huge. It's really early in the morning where you are. You're on the west coast of the States, aren't you?
Yes, West Hollywood, California.
Wow. Do you ever see the film stars in your neck of the woods?
Sometimes, yeah, quite a bit. I mean, the tour trucks can continually come by hoping to get a glimpse of somebody famous. So,
well, it's great to have you on. You've been a fairly recent listener, but since you started listening, the emails have come thick and fast from you in relation to the various topics that we cover. So I had trouble trying to get you down to just one or two questions for Amy for today's show.
Right.
But Amy's here now. So what did you want to ask Amy in the time that we've got, Jay?
Well, I think the thing that really kind of sticks out in my mind, Justin, is, you know, all the programs that you've done, and I think they have been excellent, just to get people talking. It seems that, you know, there is a problem. And I know growing up and moving away from the Christian faith after most of my life being a Christian, you just feel like when you get into discussions with individuals of the faith, all of a sudden it gets into a very contentious dialogue. And then the insults start flowing, and before you know it, you haven't really accomplished anything. And in my opinion, in the last 40 years that I've been around, things really haven't changed that much. I mean, in some ways, the arguments have intensified, which isn't good. And I'll just end it with this, but my whole effort here is that when I get up in the morning and I'm looking to see what we can do with the world problems, with globalization, with the introduction of technology, with, you know, the environmental issues and unemployment and things like that. And we really do need people to get along and try to solve these problems. And anything that tends to separate people or divide people is not good. So I guess one of my questions to Amy would be, is that what is her feeling in terms of how this can maybe be avoided, and why do Christians feel that the secular groups are really insulting them, and why do the secular people feel like the Christians are really talking down to them, and how do we get beyond this, I guess is the question.
Okay. Yeah, Amy.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I do come to the States every now and then, a few times a year, and it's something that I've noticed. You know, some social commentators call it the culture wars, and the church has really become co-opted by a sort of angry political movement that I personally think is very unhelpful and not really reflective of, you know, what Jesus taught or how he lived or what a Christian's priority should be. So when you were talking about kind of changing the world, I was thinking about Martin Luther King, who, you know, inspired by his Christian faith, gave his civil rights speech, I Have a Dream, you know, quoting vociferously from the King James Bible. Or for us here in the UK, the major campaign to sort of drop third world debt and for the British government to kind of forgive the debt of 41 countries was led largely by churches. But, you know, there were plenty of other political groups active in that movement too. And, you know, Gordon Brown, when he was the Chancellor, got up to give that speech talking about Britain dropping that debt. He quoted from the book of Isaiah. So for me, it's sad to hear that the Christian faith is not associated with a kind of passion for the common good, for the environment, for justice issues in society. In the States, in your experience, I'm sure there are pockets of it, but certainly here, and as a Christian myself, that's something we would seek to do, to, you know, follow Christ and motivated by him to have a love for neighbour and a love for the world and a care about those sorts of issues.
No, I would just say that, you know, the polarization of the groups is you really see a visceral response to the arguments that are presented. And I'll just give you one example, you know, that is evident within the fundamentalist right in the United States. Somebody like a Mike Huckabee will stand up after the children were murdered up in Connecticut in the school. I mean, riddled with bullets.
Terrible.
Little children riddled,
yeah,
with bullets. And he would stand up and said on TV, "This is because we're pushing God out of the schools."
Oh, gosh.
And
Well, do you know, I hope you're encouraged to hear, but most Christians who would hear that here would just think, oh my goodness, please. Let's not do that. Let's not say that. I suppose what I would want to say to you is I'm really sorry that the church does misrepresent Jesus in that way, but to encourage you not to reject the person of Christ and who he was on the basis of people who, you know, claim to be emulating him, but maybe are doing that imperfectly. And the second thing would be to say that at the heart of the Christian message is this whole idea that as human beings, all of us are desperately in need of forgiveness, and, you know, that we can't by our own efforts make ourselves good. We need Christ, we need his forgiveness, we need his sacrifice of himself on the cross. And so when we see failings and, you know, divisions, in a way it underlines even more the need for God and the need for his forgiveness and his empowering.
Well, I just think, I hear what you're saying. I just think we just do need an understanding, because, you know, whether you are a Christian or you're a humanist or whatever faith you are, you know, digging our heels in and circling the wagons to try to reinforce what our belief systems are doesn't really serve any purpose.
Well, it's absolutely counterproductive, isn't it, as well? It doesn't work either. It's very unpersuasive. And, yeah, I mean, I guess I would want to go back to the early church and look at how the disciples lived, look at how Jesus lived, look at the principle of self-sacrifice and love of others and the kind of radical generosity that you see taught in the Bible, and encourage you to look into that and maybe to overlook some of the cultural trappings of
I think probably sometimes, Jay, you've got in touch with me and said, Justin, you know, you do all these programs about, you know, does God exist and doctrine and things like that. Is that really important at the end of the day? Aren't there bigger issues to worry about? And I appreciate what you're saying there, but in a sense, I wouldn't want you to mistake what happens here on the program for the whole of Christianity, in the sense that the vast majority of my Christian friends aren't doing this. They're in their community, they're doing great stuff, they're working with the youth, they're patrolling the streets, helping people who are drunk on a Friday night in a kind of, you know, church project. So I'm just worried that maybe because you're very aware of the cultural things going on and the debates and so on, that you're mistaking that's all that there is, because that's not the picture I get, Jay.
Well, I think in fairness, I've been around quite a bit, and I understand a lot of the good things and was on that side of the issue, seeing all the good things that are done in both communities, in all communities, for everybody. So I see all the good things that are done, so I don't want to dismiss that out of hand. So I do understand that, Justin, and I guess it just hurts me I guess my question, Amy, to you is, you know, there seems to be, this hasn't really changed over 40 years. I mean, we all say that we want to get back and we want to live a good life and we want to pattern ourselves after people like the Christians who admire Jesus, and we want to do that. But it just doesn't seem to be, there's something deeper behind this that creates this animosity and this, it's either my way or the highway attitude, and it doesn't seem to be getting better.
That's an interesting observation, but I'm reminded of a report that came out here that was looking at numbers of people sort of involved in volunteering charitably in the country and how many millions of pounds that sort of saved our UK government, and seeing from the statistics how a personal faith in God, and really specifically a Christian faith, did seem to motivate people to work for and serve their communities. So I'm sorry that is the evidence that you observe in America, is this sort of divided culture warring. And I know that is the case. I've experienced that personally as well. And I think there are reasons for that, historical reasons. But I hope the corner is turning, and I would want to suggest to you that that is not actually the global picture, and where you see genuinely Christian communities trying to follow Christ and you know, inspired by his example, you see actual radical good being done in communities in Christ's name. And that's, you know, that's rational when you believe in a God that's personal, a God that has created human beings with intrinsic value, as opposed to having a reductionist view of humanity, that it's the survival of the fittest and the weak should be crushed. And, you know, there's no sort of sacredness of the human person. So I would say that, you know, the logical outworking of following Christ should be and would be loving communities, radically self-denying and serving a wider group of people, whether they're believers in God or not. And where that's not the case, then that's not a genuine reflection of who Christ is.
We are going to have to wind things up there. Thank you very much, Jay, for being on the programme today, and apologies as ever that we can't spend more time on these interactions in this format, but it's been very interesting getting a variety of perspectives today. So just coming to the end of the second part of the show, and we'll just say a quick sort of thank you and goodbye to Amy in the next section. You're listening to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, talking a number of different issues, thanks to the sceptics and atheists and non-Christians who have come on for the show to talk to Amy Orr Ewing, my guest on the show today. We'll be back in a moment's time.
Do the Bible and science really contradict each other? Is there really a historical Adam and Eve? These are only a few of the questions that seem to indicate an apparent conflict between science and faith, and this is why Reasons to Believe exists. RTB's mission is to demonstrate that sound reason and scientific research consistently support, rather than erode, confidence in the truth of the Bible. Our work shows how the record of nature and the record of Scripture reveal the God of the Bible as Creator, Lord, and Savior. Find out how you also can give a skeptical world reasons to believe. Visit us today at reasons.org.
Welcome back to the third and final part of this week's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. And don't forget, you can hear this online if you're listening via the radio station at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That's the place to go for all the news and info you need on the programme, including links, of course, to Unbelievable, the conference 2013. I do hope that you can join me and Amy, who's been my guest on the show today, and a range of other speakers at what really is the evangelism and apologetics training event of the year. It's in 2 weeks' time, on Saturday the 25th of May, here in central London. Looking forward to having hundreds of people come along and learn, engage, pick up resources and meet the speakers, and a whole range of issues that are going to be discussed and talked about. Evidence for Christ, what do we do with suffering, the science-faith debate, how do we make the case for faith online. If you want to book in, that's premier.org.uk/Jesus. Bring a friend and you'll get a free DVD by booking two tickets. premier.org.uk/Jesus. And one of our speakers, Kurt Jaros, is going to be joining me a little bit later on in the show today. He's going to be speaking on the subject of how to do apologetics well online, sharing your faith online. He's the author, the owner of Real Clear Apologetics. It's an excellent new apologetics resource website and blog site where people can get on and start to interact with each other. So listen out for him a little later on in today's programme. But if you want to book in and come along yourself, hear some great speakers. It's premier.org.uk/Jesus. Time now to finish up our conversation today with my special guest, Amy Orr Ewing.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, thank you so much, Amy, for being on the show with me today. Yeah, a really interesting variety of questions and people on the show today, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, really fascinating to hear some of the questions and objections that people have. But for me, yeah, it does come back to that personal God who wants to know us, and who through Christ has made a way for us to know him. I just think that makes sense of, you know, those bigger questions about why would we love people, and even what meditation is, that it's within that context of relationship rather than a sort of impersonal vacuum.
Yeah, well, thank you again for coming on. And if you're interested in perhaps interacting with Amy, then why not come along to Unbelievable, the conference as well, where she's one of our speakers and will be leading some really interesting seminars, as I've mentioned earlier on in the programme. Amy, you are incredibly busy, so thank you for making time to
schedule. Thanks for having me.
And please pass our love on to everyone at the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. And
I will do, absolutely.
And blessings on all that you guys are doing there.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's Amy Orr Ewing. Well, we'll be hearing some of your feedback in a moment's time here on the show. If you want to get in touch, you want to let us know what you thought of the conversations Amy was having today with Jay, with Rachel and with Trevor, then I'd encourage you to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And I know some people are going to email in and say, oh, you didn't get into enough depth, you know, there wasn't enough sort of hard, gritty debate or something like that. Well, that's fine. It's a different format. We do that often on the show, last week being no exception with the debate on abortion between Trevor Stammers and Evan Harris. But a little bit of a different, more of a bite-sized sort of feel to the programme today. But I know that many people enjoy the variety. So if you want to get in touch, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, you can get in touch on the social media sites. @unbelievablejb is the Twitter. Facebook.com/unbelievablejb is the Facebook account. And lots of people leaving their thoughts there as well, both on the Facebook group, where there's a lot of debate between Christians and atheists, and also on the Facebook page. I posted up the shows from this week, last week at least, with Trevor Stammers and Evan Harris on abortion, and lots of response that's had too on the email. So we'll go to some of that in a moment's time. Well, I'm very glad to be joined on the line now by Kurt Jaros of Real Clear Apologetics, who of course are one of the conference partners at this year's Unbelievable, the Conference 2013. A very good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Justin. Thanks for having me.
It's lovely to have you, though of course it's morning for you where you are in the States at the moment.
That's right.
We're really looking forward to you joining us at Unbelievable, the conference this year, Kurt. For those, though, who don't know who you are, don't know what you do, could you give us a little bit of your background? Have you always been a Christian, for instance, is a good place to start?
Yes. Well, I was born and raised in a Christian home, and I don't just mean that my parents took me to church on Christmas and Easter. They dragged me to church every Sunday, and I sat in the pew and listened to the sermons, and I paid attention in Sunday school, and that's where I really learned about the Bible, and my interest began to take in what the Bible was telling me about the world and what it's like. So I was born in a Christian home, and went on through the public education system here, gaining general knowledge. And when I was in high school, I began to be interested in apologetics. I began to ask questions regarding truth, what is truth, how should we live.
Is that because your experience at that point meant you were coming into contact with people who were asking tougher questions about your faith?
Yes, and perhaps more so, I was noticing people calling themselves Christians, but not really believing it or acting that way. And so I would talk to a lot of people in high school, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, learning more about what they believed. And, of course, that in turn then challenged me to articulate my beliefs.
I think that's probably the route that a lot of young people go into apologetics via, and probably more so than ever these days with the easiness of finding other people's views online, that can often spur it on. But before we go to that, before we talk about the nature of online apologetics now, a little bit more then. So you, this kind of developed into some kind of a passion, I suppose.
Yeah. So I remained a Christian and kind of took my parents' faith as my own, so to speak, in high school. That's when I really, grasped this concept of having it be my own. And, at my undergraduate days at Biola University, questions, deeper questions remained of how we relate to God and, you know, what does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? So theological questions still remained. And so I went on to do a graduate degree in apologetics at Biola, which was a wonderful experience. But then I started to pursue theology more, and I'm still pursuing it right now. As I did another master's at King's College London last year, and now I'm looking into various PhD programs. And so I'm really interested in the question these days of common grace, general revelation, and natural theology, the effects of sin on humans. So really this gets to the question of, can we even do natural theology? Or does natural theology have any intrinsic value? So that's kind of my interest in between apologetics and theology. That's how I toe the line.
Sure, in a nutshell, yeah. And when it comes to online apologetics, because you have started a website called Real Clear Apologetics, Kurt. How has this kind of changed the game as far as the interaction between Christians and non-Christians in your lifetime, as it were, in the way that Christians are increasingly, I suppose, being called upon to defend their beliefs?
Yeah, so a couple things that I'm trying to do with this website. One of the features is that I'm just hoping to create an aggregate of scholarly information by both Christians and atheists. So this could mean something like finding YouTube videos and bringing them over to the website, or newspaper articles, or even better yet, articles that appear in scholarly journals. Some websites provide abstracts, so I'm hoping to help people better understand the other side. It's really important for Christians to know what atheists believe or even ought to believe, so that they can dialogue well with people and not set up straw men. And likewise for the other side. I mean, it's important for atheists to understand what Christians believe. This, I think, could lead to healthier dialogue.
Yeah, I know that certainly in the world of Facebook and Twitter, it can be a bit of a dogfight, the discussion forums and so on, between Christians and non-Christians. And I don't know, are you trying to do something then to kind of raise the game, as it were, of what's going on online in that way?
Right, yes. So not only am I doing that, but like you said, with Facebook and Twitter, it can be pretty harsh on there. And so another feature to the website is it's a basic social networking site. So you have your own little profile. You can message with people. There are forums where you can debate. But one of the best features, I think, is everybody who creates a free username gets their own blog. And so there's this whole blogosphere out there of people debating and writing responses to each other, very similar to, like, peer review, right? Mm-hmm. But not done in journal articles, done at the popular level on the Internet. And so here I'm hoping to, like you said, up the game and perhaps be even a little bit more civil than sometimes these dogfights that break up on Facebook and Twitter.
So an aim to elevate the conversation a bit there. When it comes to those who are engaging on a regular basis, though, whether it be on Facebook, Twitter, or something like Real Clear Apologetics, any tips, maybe your top three tips for those who are doing that online? Because in my experience, talking to someone online, because of the anonymity that's involved, can be quite different to talking to someone face-to-face. I think people say things online very often in those kinds of forums that they wouldn't actually say to someone face-to-face.
Yeah, that's right.
Any tips for having a fruitful dialogue rather than more heat than light?
Yeah, so The first tip, kind of what you pointed out, I would say be yourself, or imagine that you are speaking to someone in person. Like you said, a lot of people can go on there and be pretty nasty. Christians, too, and this just gives us a bad name. And it's all because the Internet has this effect where it takes down boundaries or barriers to, like, what we would have in normal conversations. That's the first tip. The second tip is don't waste your time. There are some discussions that are clearly a waste of time. You can see that both people, they're not going to learn from each other. It's only going to get worse. So we have to be discerning in the right conversations. And I've even discovered in my time on the web, there are some people who will create fake profiles to entice people. This is no joke. Fake profiles to entice people to just waste their time.
Sock puppet accounts, they're sometimes called, aren't they?
Yeah. So, again, we've got to be really discerning. And then my third tip would be for some people. So the second tip for some people is to be discerning. The third tip is also to be discerning. There are some people who have come to think that it's no longer worth our time to do apologetics online, that it's just not useful. Now, they might have some concerns, like they want good concerns, like we should work on our relationships with people we interact with, and that's great. But there still is value in doing this online. And as Mike Lycona once told me, he said sometimes it's not about winning the debate for the other person. It's about doing the debate so other people can see. Other people can see, oh, there is the Christian there. Mm. He knows what he's talking about, or he or she knows what they're talking about. There are good reasons for believing. So we might be unaware of the person it might help.
Indeed, and I think that's always worth bearing in mind, is very often we can think that we're only talking to maybe the three or four people who may be involved in a given conversation, but very often you don't know who's lurking but not participating, who may well be taking something away from the way you're conducting yourself and the things you're actually posting. But yeah. Very helpful tips. Thank you very much, Kurt. Appreciate that.
No problem.
I'm so looking forward to hearing more about Real Clear Apologetics at the conference, hearing your seminar on doing online apologetics and evangelism. But if people want to visit the website ahead of the conference, can you give us the web address for it?
Yeah, very simple. realclearapologetics.com.
Fantastic. It's as easy as that. Go and check it out. See what Kurt's been posting there recently. And perhaps join up, get that username, get your own blog, and start to elevate the conversation when it comes to online apologetics. Thank you so much for joining me to have a little chat ahead of the conference, Kurt. And we look forward to seeing you very soon.
Thanks, Justin. It was a pleasure.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And once again, if you want to find out more, if you want to book yourself in to the conference where both Amy and Kurt, and indeed Alistair McGrath, Peter S. Williams, Trevor Stammers, who am I forgetting? There's one more person, isn't there? Oh, Fuzz Rana. Reasons to Believe. They're all there, all speaking at this year's Unbelievable, the conference, Saturday the 25th of May, just 2 weeks away now. So what are you waiting for? Get yourself booked in at premier.org.uk/Jesus, and I look forward to meeting you. Do come and say hello. I'm always busy on the day, but I'm never too busy to stop and say hi and just to hear who you are and how you found the show and what's going on. So look forward to meeting lots of friends of Unbelievable in 2 weeks' time. Let's talk about the response to last week's abortion show. This was Dr. Trevor Stammers, a GP, former GP, who for 30 years as a Christian practiced medicine. He was in conversation with Dr. Evan Harris, an atheist. Jeremy wants to say thanks for having the debate. Just wanted to send along some names that would be great knowledgeable resources for the future. Possibly the best person on this topic from a Christian perspective is Scott Klusendorf, author of The Case for Life. Another very good person would be Greg Kuchel. Yes, I'm in touch with Scott and indeed Greg via Facebook and other methods. And well, if next time Scott's in the UK, I certainly am going looking to bring him on this subject. He is pretty much seen as one of the go-to people on the pro-life front when it comes to debating the issues. Dewey also emails in, and this, I suppose it goes to show that this issue cuts across just typical atheist Christian lines, because Dewey is an atheist, as far as I best remember, Dewey, from your previous emails to me, but takes very much a pro-life position from what I can tell from your email. You say, we're all dependent in one way or another. Are fetuses really potential human beings only? Is there really a fundamental difference between the unborn child at 24 weeks and when it's younger? It's true, I'm not dependent on any one human being as much as an unborn child is, but I do depend on other human beings for my life nonetheless. In any case, I can't see how or why complete dependency makes the unborn less than human. They say the unborn before 24 weeks is just a fetus. In Latin, it means offspring. Well, an offspring is a child, and a child is an offspring. Sometimes, of course, you need a new word for a new thing, and words borrowed from Latin don't always mean the same in English as they did at their source. But then what does fetus mean in English if it doesn't mean offspring? I suppose it may have been used first by doctors simply because Latin was once the language of learning. To them, it meant unborn child. The idea that it should mean a potential child, a non-human being, well, that came along later, I think. Is there a need for it? The liberals who defend abortion seem to think that the word is an argument in itself, and that they need only say it isn't a child, it's a fetus, and that should be enough to convince or silence their critics who claim that it is a child. If it looks like a child and may respond to its mother's voice in the womb, how can they say it's essentially different and not yet human? If they don't see that it's a child, it's because they're seeing through the eyes of liberal fascism, says Dewey. This is Eric in Knoxville, Tennessee, says, I was excited to find your podcast a few months ago. I've enjoyed the excellent discussions. It's hard to get used to the very civil discussion on such emotional topics that are easy to get passionate about. This week's discussion on abortion was interesting, to say the least. However, I hope the Christian perspective isn't beginning to slip. Here's what I mean. Issues such as abortion and same-sex marriage used to be regarded as moral issues, issues of conscience. Yet we see that kind of language all but gone, even in the realm of Christianity. The discussion has changed from what's moral and immoral to what is legal and illegal. Because abortion is legal, some feel Christians therefore have no reason to raise their voices. Christians no longer seem to come at this from a moral perspective, and it isn't one we can ever win from a legal perspective. Even the bantering among you three as you discuss the technicalities of the 24-week period, after which abortion becomes illegal, was hard to listen to. Do Christians somehow lose their compassion when they disagree with abortion completely? Do we lose the right to be taken seriously because we approach abortion as a moral issue? Legal or not, it's always murder, says Eric. Oh, and look, here's one from Jay too, who was our last caller on the programme today. Jay almost always emails in his thoughts on a given programme. The abortion debate, Jay says, I followed the entire discussion and it sounded like a conversation on human rights. Not sure any of the speakers advanced the Christian scriptural conclusions for or against. These are very complex issues, along with topics like stem cell research. Finding the Bible to be woefully inadequate and of no value in the 21st century. The lack of biblical relevance around this issue spoke volumes. Seems like the need to advance a code for universal preferred behaviour is becoming more and more obvious, moving further away from the ancient text, says Jay, which I suppose is a reflection on what Eric's saying there, where he says we need to get back to the issue whether this is a moral issue. Not just the legalities of the issue. And Jay suggesting, well, once we stop talking about the Bible in this context, we've really got no use for it. Well, I think perhaps the fact is we were doing more of a technical discussion between two doctors. Medical aspects were really the focus of last week's debate. That's not to say there isn't a very interesting debate to be had on the moral issues, these particularly what scripture has to say about it. It's just that in the public arena, generally, you can't make an argument these days, it seems, on the basis of your personal religious beliefs about what the Bible might say on a particular issue. You have to make the case from, if you like, a more secular point of view. And I think many of those in the pro-life camp think there is a perfectly valid, reasonable, secular reasons why abortion is immoral and should not be undertaken. in a civil society. In any case, thank you for your thoughts. This is one is from Ayubami, says, I don't believe, no matter how people want to make it look, that abortion is okay. It's still a great sin and cruelty to life. This is a life we're talking about. Just like someone really famous today gave a testimony on how his mother tried to abort him but wasn't successful. He's now a well-known man of God, says Ayubami. Thank you very much for emailing in. Let's see if we've got some more on this abortion issue. Here's one from Ian, who says, thanks for the podcast. I always look forward to listening to it on my commute to work in Muscat, Oman. I've also got a handful of emails I've started writing to you in response to certain programs, but never got round to finishing them. The latest on abortion was interesting, but ultimately frustrating. Both guests traded a lot in anecdotes, parables, and extremes, which obscured the real issues. The real issue in my mind is, what is a woman free to choose? To terminate a 10-day-old fetus? To terminate an almost viable 20-week fetus? Or to kill a baby a few hours after birth? Currently, there seems to be a soft limit and a hard limit to abortion. Before viability, a woman can practically have an abortion on demand. After that, they can get an abortion for what is deemed a serious reason. After birth, putting an end to the baby's life would be a criminal offence. Whatever way you look at it, abortion puts an end to a potential human life. For something so serious, I'm amazed that the limits to this are so flimsy. While I'm currently strongly in the pro-life camp, I could genuinely reconsider if some scientific advance showed that up until a certain stage of development, a fetus was fundamentally less than human. I was glad that you tried to direct the conversation in this direction at times, but disappointed that no real progress seemed to be made. There, finally, I've completed an email to your show. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much for getting in touch, Ian. And thanks to everyone who's been getting in touch this week. We're already out of time, I'm afraid. Many more emails received this week, both on that subject and on other subjects besides. Thank you for getting in touch. If you want to get in touch yourself, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. That's the email address. And I will be revealing the winner of the C.S. Lewis books next week. The three winners of signed copies of Alistair McGrath's new book, C.S. Lewis, A Life. So come back for that as well if you entered that competition. I've got a stack of entries now that have come in over the last couple of weeks since we did that. And of course, a reminder that Alistair McGrath is one of our keynote speakers at this year's Unbelievable, the conference. The place where, if you're interested in making the case, the rational, reasonable, intellectual case for Christianity to sceptical friends, come along to this conference. You will pick up some amazing tips, knowledge, and just be able to interact with people who have made this their life study, making a rational case for the Christian faith. Unbelievable, the conference 2013, 2 weeks away now, Saturday the 25th of May. Do book in at premier.org.uk/Jesus. That's all from me for this week. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. You're unbelievable. We're going to be hearing from Fuz Rana again, one of our guests at this year's Unbelievable, the conference, but also others involved in the science faith debate from a Christian perspective. Dr. Dennis Alexander joins me in the studio, and we're going to be having on the line from the States Peter Enns. Well, if those names mean anything to you, you've probably guessed that we're going to be talking about the historical Adam and Eve. Was there a historical Adam and Eve? How should Christians interpret the book of Genesis? And what does the scientific genetic record tell us about where humanity came from and so on? Three different views represented next week in what is going to be a fascinating theological and scientific show. So I hope you can come back for that. A few people have asked for this show, and we finally got it together, and some fantastic guests taking part. So come back same time next week for Unbelievable as we ask, was there a historical Adam and Eve? That's the show that aims to get you thinking. Unbelievable. Until then, have a great week.